Tanter Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents What I Learned About Investing from Darwin by Puluk Prasad, narrated by Sean K. Jain. Introduction. With such moderate abilities as I possess, it is truly surprising that thus I should have influenced to a considerable extent the beliefs of scientific men on some important points. Charles Darwin. Last sentence of the Autobiography of Charles Darwin, 1809 to 1882, August 3, 1876. Ben Graham taught me 45 years ago that in investing it is not necessary to do extraordinary things to get extraordinary results. Warren Buffett, Annual Letter to Shareholders, 1994. Evolutionary biology, as the name suggests, is the study of the causes and nature of the evolution of organisms since the beginning of life on Earth. Investing, unlike the name suggests, is all too often a euphemism for gambling, in which the practitioners rarely do better than dart-throwing primates. Superficially, there are many other differences between the two fields. Evolutionary biology is practiced by serious professionals, and the investment field is dominated by amateurs who take themselves too seriously. Knowledge and the quest for truth motivate evolutionary biologists. For most investors, knowledge and truth be damned, so long as their 2 per 20 is protected. Evolutionary biologists perform a tremendous amount of research in narrow fields, e.g., secondary contact and genomic admixture between rhesus and long-tailed macaques in the Indochina Peninsula. Investors, on the other hand, make confident pronouncements, e.g., I think the markets will rise 10% this year, based on spurious spreadsheets, flawed assumptions, and inflated egos. The biggest difference, though, is that the two are moving in opposite directions. Evolutionary biologists continue to become better at their craft, whereas investors continue to get worse. In recent years, biologists have used Darwin's evolutionary theory to explain things like the origin of the human hepatitis virus, the consequences of sexual selection acting on female animals, the effect of microbiomes on the evolution of animals, the link between cultural inheritance among the great apes and Darwinian evolution, and the effect of gene flow on evolution of species. If you explore the evolution section of any scientific journal, for example, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, available at pnas.org, you will be dazzled by the range of research topics and the stunning advances being made by scientists. But the investment community? It doesn't matter how you look at it. The data are ugly, really ugly, and it shows that we, the fund managers, are idiots. According to a 2021 S&P report on the U.S. equity market called the SPIVA U.S. Scorecard, across periods of 5, 10, and 20 years, 75 to 90% of U.S. domestic funds underperformed the market. Let that fact sink in before you continue any further. About 75 to 90% of fund managers, most of whom have graduate degrees, including MBAs, from elite schools and manage trillions of dollars, fail to beat the market. If you are part of the financial services community, you may believe that it is easier to outperform the small cap market benchmarks. Not true. The market outperformed about 93% of small-cap funds during the 10-year period from 2011 to 2021. That is bad enough, but the dismal news does not end there. Not only are most U.S. funds underperforming, but they have also gotten worse over time. According to the same S&P report, in 2009, over 3- and 5-year periods, 10- and 20-year periods were not reported, only 55 to 60% of U.S. domestic funds had underperformed the market. This phenomenon is not unique to the United States. In the Indian equity market, as of 2017, 43 to 53% of large cap funds had underperformed benchmarks over 3- and 5-year periods. However, as of 2020, those numbers had become much worse. About 70 to 80% of large-cap funds had been unable to beat their benchmarks over periods of 3, 5, and 10 years. No wonder passively managed funds have been growing at a much faster pace than active mutual funds. According to a 2020 Deloitte report, since 2009, U.S. passive funds, valued at $6.6 trillion in 2018, had grown by more than four times, whereas U.S. active funds, valued at $11.4 trillion, had grown by less than 1.7 times. The reason? The performance of U.S. passive funds handsomely beat that of U.S. active funds during that period. I know you may now be asking the following questions. How in the world can an obscure field like evolutionary biology be a solution to this problem? What is it that investors' overpriced and overvalued MBA educations did not teach them that a study of Darwinian evolution could? What can the folks who worship abstractions like cash flow, price earnings, PE ratios, and capital asset pricing models learn from the people who spend decades digging up fossil specimens, argue whether Neanderthals had sex with humans, and accord a godlike status to a 19th century Englishman who studied earthworms, pigeons, and barnacles? A lot, I will argue. But before we get there, who am I, and why did I write this book? Who am I? I'm an equity fund manager. In 2007, I founded an investment firm called Nalanda Capital, which currently manages a little more than $5 billion U.S. dollars invested in listed Indian securities. Nalanda's investment philosophy can be summarized in 10 words. We want to be permanent owners of high-quality businesses. Let me repeat that. We want to be permanent owners. We don't invest unless we think we can own a business forever. A bad business that is dirt cheap? Pass. A mediocre business at a low price? Thanks, but no thanks. A high-quality business at a fair price? Give me more so I can never let go. We invest almost exclusively in businesses owned and run by entrepreneurs, of which the entrepreneur is typically the largest shareholder, and we are usually the second largest. Nalanda's approach to investing comprises three straightforward, sequential steps. 1. Avoid big risks. 2. Buy high quality at a fair price. 3. Don't be lazy. Be very lazy. That's it. This straightforward investment process has led to the following outcome. 1 rupee, INR 1, invested in Nalanda's first fund at its inception in June 2007, would have been worth INR 13.8 in September 2022. The same amount invested in India's Sensex, the country's large cap index, would have been worth INR 3.9, and if invested in the mid cap index, would have been worth only INR 4. Over a little more than 15 years, based on actual cash inflows and outflows, the annualized rupee return for this fund was 20.3% after all our fees, and the fund beat both the Sensex and the mid-cap index by 10.9 percentage points. That is not a bad track record. Before founding Nalanda, I worked for almost 9 years at the global private equity firm Warburg Pincus. Before that, I spent 6 years at the management consulting firm McKinsey & Company, serving clients in India, South Africa, and the United States. My consulting clients ranged from a South African retail bank, a U.S. technology company, and a Swiss insurer, to an Indian conglomerate. As an investor, I have been on the board of an Israeli services company, a Singaporean food company, and an Indian telecommunications company, among a couple dozen others. My investments have been across early-stage companies, through which I lost money, to late-stage ones, through which I made some money. As you can see, I haven't done anything. I haven't been responsible for meeting production deadlines, managing a sales team, turning around troubled companies, or launching and managing brands. What I have done, though, for almost 3 decades of my consulting and investing career, is observe. Not being in a day-to-day operational role has afforded me the luxury of stepping back to think about what works in the corporate world and what doesn't. This experience across industries, companies, and continents may qualify me to pontificate on the peculiarities of a pizza delivery business model. But I will not begrudge you for questioning my authority to speak on matters of evolution when I do not have a degree in evolutionary theory. My defense is the same as the one given by Mary Jane West Eberhard in her stunningly original book, Development Plasticity and Evolution. I can read. I blame my passion for investing on luck. I stumbled on this profession in 1998, and for evolutionary theory, oddly enough, on Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's longtime friend and confidant. Munger was the chair of Wesco Financial until Berkshire Hathaway bought it in 2011. Like Buffett at Berkshire's legendary annual meetings, Munger held forth on a wide range of subjects at Wesco's annual meetings. In 2000, in response to a question about his favorite books, Munger recommended The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins. I read the notes of this meeting in 2002 and decided to buy the book. My life hasn't been the same since. I found the subject of Darwinian evolution extraordinarily fascinating and enriching. Thanks to Amazon and Borders, Oh, I Miss You So, I have been reading books on the subject for about 2 decades now. These include popular books, esoteric books, and graduate course books, books on insects, vertebrates, and humans, books that deal with highly specialized areas such as genetics, and books on the general theory of evolution, books on the philosophy of evolution, and books that deal only with mathematical concepts applied to evolution. Yes, there is a lot of math in biology. I can't say that I am an expert in evolutionary theory, but I think I can hold a reasonably coherent conversation on the subject with an expert. By the way, I can't say I am an expert even in investing. I can admit only to being a passionate practitioner. Why this book? It was only after I had read dozens of books on evolution that I realized why I was so deeply absorbed in the subject. Almost every topic I studied in evolutionary biology has parallels to investing in general and to the Nalanda way of investing in particular. The more I studied Darwinian evolution, a new hobby, the more I learned about investing, an old passion. This book is about how we can derive the core investment principles of long-term and patient investing from the basic concepts of evolutionary biology, the very epitome of a long-term process. While this is a book on investing, it is not an Investing 101 book. I will not be discussing depreciation methods, lease accounting policies, or valuing intangibles. You can learn those things from hundreds of other sources. I will not be dissecting valuation ratios or commenting on off-balance sheet accounting. I will also not reveal any new investing techniques. This book is about adopting a new mindset for investing, about reimagining investing by applying the time-tested principles of biological evolution. I will deliberate the counterintuitive Darwinian evolutionary principles that can be called upon to understand the business world, thereby helping investors excel at their craft. What you will discover in the following is a description, not a prescription. It's a description of our strategy, of investing at Nalanda and its uncanny parallels to evolutionary theory. Instead of saying, this is what you should do, this book says, this is what we have done. As mentioned, most investors have a poor long-term track record. The implication of this is obvious. Most investment methods don't work over the long run. Ours has. And so here I am, sharing my thoughts with you. This book is for many types of listeners. If you are an amateur investor, this book should intrigue you as you discover exciting parallels between the natural world and the world of money. Second, this book is for professional investors who are Buffett fans. Okay, agreed. Everyone is a Buffett fan. This book is for Buffett fans who try to invest the way he does. While you may not learn any new tricks here, you will learn to visualize Buffett's core investment principles in an entirely new light as you peer through the lens of evolutionary biology. The third group who may find this book interesting is science buffs. Most people of science avoid thinking about money like the plague, but the opportunity cost of not investing well can be substantial. For those individuals, this book may nudge you toward thinking more actively about investing your money well, especially because the concepts discussed here will resonate with you. This book is also for those with eclectic taste who are looking for something interesting. You may not find this book to be an Agatha Christie-esque page-turner, but hopefully your gray cells will be tickled. If you are an expert on investing, you may not agree with many or all of the investing-related topics I discuss. And if you are an evolutionary biologist, you may scoff at some or all of the themes I present. But the great thing about these two vast areas of knowledge is that there are almost no fixed laws in biology or in investing, in contrast to the many immutable laws in physics and chemistry. Just as scientists can't agree on the definition of what constitutes a species or a gene, investors have wildly different opinions on calculating something as simple as a business's value. The three elements of Nalanda's investment strategy. In this book, I describe one method of long-term investing and its parallels with Darwinian evolutionary biology, the way we invest at Nalanda as permanent owners. I've organized the book into three sections that mirror the three elements of our strategy. Section 1, avoid big risks. Section 2, buy high quality at a fair price. Section 3, don't be lazy. Be very lazy. Section 1 highlights the most basic investing lesson of all. Avoid big risks. Don't lose money. Like most deceptively simple things in life, this is easier said than done. Yes, not losing money is a skill, maybe a skill harder to learn than making money. As Warren Buffett has famously said, rule number 1, never lose money. Rule number 2, don't forget rule number 1. Have you noticed that almost every book on investing provides strategies and tactics that encourage you to do things a certain way? Some advise you to trade based on market signals, some recommend buying value stocks, and some urge you to bet on AI and biotech startups. These books are about making money. You do not see books telling you how not to lose money. The sad reality is that unless an investor learns to avoid losses, their investment career is likely to be short and brutal. Section 2 sums up Nalanda's second mantra, buy high quality at a fair price. It focuses on the nuts and bolts of Nalanda's buying process, as seen from the perspective of Darwinian evolutionary theory. Chapters 2 to 4 deal with what to buy, and chapters 5 to 7 explore how to buy. Section 3 covers the third area of Nalanda's investment approach. Don't be lazy, be very lazy. We buy rarely, and we sell even more rarely. In this world of non-stop action where Nike's slogan, "Just Do It," seems to be the core mantra of a successful life, our core tenet of "just don't do it" may seem out of place. In this section, I describe the logic of our laziness by invoking three concepts from evolutionary theory. I then conclude by drawing a lesson from an intriguing creature that even Darwin could not understand, the honeybee. In the following sections, you will encounter many facets of Darwinian evolutionary theory that have laid the groundwork for our investing philosophy at Nalanda. This book is a compendium of analogies. As you may have discovered while persuading or being persuaded by someone, analogies can be useful for making a case, any case. So be careful. Treat the evolution lessons for what they are, a plea for investors to think long term, very long term. Section 1. Avoid big risks. This section has only one chapter, but it is the most important one in this book. If, for some reason, you stop listening after chapter 1, I believe you still will have more than gotten your money's worth. The problem with our investment community is that we don't take investing seriously. Seriously. Those of you who are in the investing profession are probably bristling with indignation right now. You travel 200 days a year, work 60 to 80 hours a week, deal with irate and demanding clients, attend excruciatingly boring conferences, your spouse and kids rarely see you, and the stress of beating the markets is making you look 10 years older than your actual age. And I have the temerity to tell you that you are not taking your job seriously? Well, if you are so angry, answer this question for me. Would you bet your life on your next investment? In this chapter, I discuss how betting your life is a remarkably sound strategy for investing, and how adopting this approach has led to the spectacular success of all living organisms over millions of years. All the investment advice from well-known books, investment gurus, and finance academics centers on making investments. This chapter is about not making investments. I will argue that learning the skill of not investing is harder and more important than learning how to invest. Chapter 1. Oh, to be a bumblebee. On the other hand, in some cases, as with the elephant and rhinoceros, none are destroyed by beasts of prey. Even the tiger in India most rarely attacks a young elephant protected by its dam. Charles Darwin, On the Origin of Species, Chapter 3, Struggle for Existence. We have written in past reports about the disappointments that usually result from purchases and operation of turnaround businesses. Literally hundreds of turnaround possibilities in dozens of industries have been described to us over the years, and either as participants or observers, we have tracked performance against expectations. Our conclusion is that with few exceptions, when a management with a reputation for brilliance tackles a business with a reputation for poor fundamental economics, it is the reputation of the business that remains intact. Warren Buffett, Annual Letter to Shareholders, 1980. When you start a book on investing, I assume you want to be dazzled by the author's brilliance. It won't happen this time. I will begin this journey by profiling my stupidity. After spending 6 years at McKinsey, I joined Warburg Pincus, a global private equity firm. After a few years of investing, I had learned the basics, or at least I thought I had. They appeared simple. Invest in a high-quality entrepreneur running a growth business, and don't overpay. I had lucked out on a couple of investments by then, and so was flying high. An entrepreneur running a successful business approached us to raise funds for expansion in the early 2000s. The business had a reasonable scale by Indian standards, and the company had many marquee clients, including one of India's largest businesses. Notably, this company had also made inroads in overseas markets. It wasn't common to see Indian companies outside the software services industry build a thriving export business in those days. I started our diligence process and did the usual. Spent time with the founder and senior managers to understand their strategy and competitive differentiation. Visited the company offices, talked to several customers in India and Europe, employed a firm specializing in forensic diligence to assess governance issues, hired the leading legal and accounting firms in India to perform diligence, and quizzed some industry experts on the company's potential for growth and value creation. Everything was looking good, and I didn't even have to haggle much on valuation or the legal documents. I communicated my enthusiasm to my bosses and got the green light. The company raised $50 million, a big sum of money for a private equity investment in India at the time, and I enthusiastically led the investment. Warburg Pincus's return on this investment? Zero. The firm lost all its money. It was entirely my fault. I had screwed up. Big time. Before making money, learn not to lose money. The next time you are in a bookshop, go to the section with investing books. Many of you below the age of 30 probably don't know what a bookshop is. No worries, go to Amazon and type in investment books. Do you notice anything common across titles that scream things like Investing 101, or One Up on Wall Street, or You Can Be a Stock Market Genius, or New Era Value Investing? All of them are about how to make money. Duh. What else is an investing book supposed to teach? I hope to convince you that an essential prerequisite for making money is the ability not to lose money. Almost everyone, and I say almost because this statement does not apply to my wife, makes mistakes. These errors fall into two broad categories. We do things we are not supposed to do, and we don't do things we are supposed to do. For me, buying a hot fudge sundae at McDonald's falls into the first category, and not keeping in regular touch with my school and college friends falls into the second. All investors, too, make these two mistakes. Let me borrow from the field of statistics to describe them. The first kind, dubbed a type 1 error by statisticians, who can never be blamed for being creative, occurs when I make a bad investment because I erroneously think it is a good one. It is the error of committing self-harm and is also called a false positive or error of commission. A type 2 error occurs when I reject a good investment because I erroneously think it is bad. This is the error of rejecting a potential benefit and can be termed a false negative or error of omission. Every investor, including Warren Buffett, makes these two errors on a regular basis. They either harm themselves or walk away from a great opportunity. As any statistician will tell you, the risk of these two errors is inversely related. Minimizing the risk of a type 1 error typically increases the risk of a type 2 error, and minimizing the risk of a type 2 error increases the risk of a type 1 error. Intuitively, this seems logical. Imagine an overly optimistic investor who sees an upside in almost every investment. This individual will not miss out on the few good investments. On the other hand, an overly cautious investor who keeps finding reasons to reject every investment is likely to make very few bad investments, but will lose out on some good investments. Investors can't have their cake and eat it too. They need to choose to be more sensitive to making one type of error while living with the consequences of making more errors of the other kind. What should one do? What should you do? In other words, which of the following investment strategies should you use? 1. Making a lot of investments so as not to lose out on some good opportunities, and as a result, living with some failed investments. Or 2. Being highly sensitive to avoid making bad investments, thereby missing out on some good investments? Let's turn to evolution to seek the answer. The goal of all animals is to survive for as long as possible, at least until they reproduce. In the animal world, everyone is both prey and predator. Yes, even we, the Homo sapiens. How are we prey? Remember COVID-19? Let's start with the prey. What would be a type 1 error for a prey animal? It would equate to inflicting sufficient harm on itself to compromise its fitness. Let me illustrate the case of an adult male deer to explore two kinds of type 1 errors. The first kind occurs when the deer is thirsty and is near a watering hole. Born by instinct or experience or both, the deer knows that the watering hole could sound its death knell if a lion or leopard or crocodile is hiding, waiting for the opportunity of an easy meal. If the deer chooses to approach the watering hole, it slakes its thirst quickly and then moves away. And if it mistakenly draws near while a predator is ready and waiting, its life ends. From the fossil record, we know that the deer that we see today evolved from ungulates about 15 to 30 million years ago. They have survived millions of years amid ferocious predators by being very sensitive to making type 1 errors, errors of not being too careful. If they weren't so, the species would have become extinct. Obviously, some individual deer do end up making the fatal error of commission by drinking at watering holes when predators are present, but the species as a whole has done remarkably well. If you have seen African wildlife videos or gone on a safari, you will have noticed how vigilant wildebeests, antelopes, zebras, and other herbivores are. They seem to see danger where there is none. But it is this alertness that has allowed them to survive and thrive for millions of years. A type 1 error of underestimating a threat could be the last error one of these animals makes. The second kind of type 1 error that the deer can commit is seen in mating rituals. One fascinating sight in the wild for me, and dare I say for the female deer, is two adult male deer fighting over the exclusive control of a harem. Let me describe the mating behavior of the red deer found in many parts of Europe and in Western and Central Asia. The males are called stags, and the females hinds. The hinds live in groups called harems. Stags, armed with impressively large antlers, fight with one another to gain exclusive mating rights to the harem females. I have put the word fight in quotation marks because the stags rarely end up fighting physically. A type 1 error, or the error of commission in this scenario, would be the mistake of committing to fighting, thereby risking becoming injured or disabled. Although the prize of a harem is quite substantial, the stags show extreme sensitivity to the type 1 error by dueling very rarely. Here is how it works. Stags are capable of mating when they reach the age of about 16 months, but they don't usually mate for the first time until they are at least 6 years old. This is because they don't develop large and powerful antlers before this age. They could fight and take a chance, but none do. They could get seriously hurt, which would compromise their fitness for future mating or even their life. When they do reach mating age, they approach the rutting grounds where hinds have gathered. But they don't start fighting immediately. Scientists have observed that locking antlers is almost always the last resort, and a rutting stag will typically fight only 5 times during the 3 weeks of the rut. A series of highly choreographed rituals that serve to actively discourage physical contact precedes the locking of horns. When two stags challenge each other, one emits an impressive roar. The other then responds with seemingly equal vigor, because sound quality is a reliable indicator of the strength of one's rival. The roaring may go on for more than an hour, with the number of roars peaking at 3 to 4 per minute. At this stage, based on the quality of roars, one of the stags typically withdraws. If they are unable to decide their relative strength based on roars, they move on to the next stage of the fight by walking with stiff legs parallel to each other. Yes, they threaten their opponent by walking. This parallel walking spectacle lasts many minutes, during which time the rivals assess each other's strength and physical condition from a distance of about 2 meters. During this period, They also thrash the vegetation and roar to appear more intimidating to
Sample complete. Ready to continue?